Hi, this is Bernie Wides, the Naturalist, back on the air today. It's a beautiful sunny day in beautiful downtown Bushwick. And we're alive, I think we're live this morning. If not, we're recorded. It's hard to tell. Okay, so today we're going to talk about bees. We had a small segment on bees in one of our other shows, at the reproductive nature of bees with their funny flight that the males do and all that stuff. But today we're going to go into it in depth. And my favorite partner here is back today with me, Carol Butler.
Greetings.
Carol, do you have the two books have come out. You want to just say a word about the two books?
Yes. Two more in the question and answer series have come out since I was here, actually. They were both slated for the spring. The book we're talking about today is Why Do Bees Buzz?, which has all kinds of interesting tidbits about bees. And the other book that came out is Do Hummingbirds Hum? Which we'll talk about hopefully on a future show.
Right, we'll save that for a future show.
Right.
So what we're going to do is we're going to do two shows on bees. This show for this week and another show for next week. So it'll be Bees 1 and Bees 2. Like, you know, you go to school, you take Biology 101 and then you take Biology 201. So we're going to break it up into two shows because there's so much great information about it. And the other reason is because spring is coming. Right. Remember I said in my last show that it's already springtime in the ocean, which starts in February because, Carol, the days get longer.
Right.
And the phytoplankton start reproducing. And everything has to be in place by the time the fish lay their eggs in the spring. All this food has to be available.
Uh-huh.
So spring on the land is starting. I took a walk in Central Park yesterday, and some of the buds are swelling already. Mm-hmm. And some of the little snowdrops, I think they're called snowdrops, little white flowers, mm-hmm. are up. So spring is coming, and bees have a lot to do with spring, which we'll talk about. And our sponsor today is Whole Foods, that great market. And so we're going to get started now. And just a word before Carol starts her talk about bees. Yeah. Okay. So my daughter Erica, by the way, is setting up a beehive, and she was going to set it up. She has a little house upstate near Peekskill, but it's a problem because she's not up there all the time to take care of it. So she's going to set it up here near Roberta's, the beehive, and hopefully she'll get to do it this spring. She couldn't do it last spring because she was traveling too much. So let's start off with some basic statistics, Carol,
okay.
on bees.
And then I am going to talk about honey in the second show. So we'll learn a little bit about the value of honey and why it makes baked products stay moist longer. It absorbs moisture. It's actually very interesting. But let's talk about some basics. There are, surprisingly, people are usually surprised by this, there are about 25,000 different species of bees around the world.
Okay, but they're all not honeybees, right?
Most of them are not honeybees,
okay.
Right. There are 3,500 species in North America. And in a study that they do in Central Park every year, which our friend Janet is involved in, they've identified 60 species of bees just in Central Park alone.
Hmm.
So there are a lot of bees.
By the way, when Janet was working in this study, it's very hard to identify these bees. Because first of all, they don't stay still long enough.
Right.
You know, and they're on the move. And we try to take pictures of them.
Right.
It was really tricky to get them in focus to
right.
do it because a lot of them look almost exactly alike.
Right, right.
Yes.
Well, we can talk about this study. The study is in the book.
Okay.
What they do, and you can correct me if I don't get it exactly right. Each person, this is through the American Museum of Natural History.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Each person gets five plants.
Right.
And they have to choose a place in the city to plant these five plants, and then on certain times of the week, they go and watch the plants for half an hour or something like that.
Right, to go to the same plants.
They go to the same, their plants, wherever they are, if they plant them in Central Park or another park or a terrace, wherever they do it, and they watch the plants for, let's say, half an hour. I have it in the book, but I didn't look at it this morning. And they record any bees that show up at the plants. They use a camera and they try to take a picture of it, and they try to identify those bees. And if they can't, they send the photos in, and the people at the museum try to identify them. And then this way they can study the number of the species that are found in each location.
Right. It was a population study to see how bees are doing in New York City.
Right.
That's what we did. My partner, Janet, got five plants.
Right.
And we... And since Janet works as a gardener in Central Park, and she has a certain zone that she works in, she put those plants in her zone. And some of them were perennials and some of them were annuals. So we went back to check on them at the end of the summer, and the one that was doing the best was the milkweed plant. The milkweed plant went crazy, and it's spreading all over the place, and it's good because,
gonna have some monarch
because we have monarch butterflies. Yeah. All over the place. Okay, so that's good. So let's get back to the bee basics.
Okay, so honeybees, we're going to talk more. The book is mostly about honeybees because they're very special, and there are many different variations on honeybees. But and there are other bees that are quite different than honeybees, that are solitary bees that don't live in a big colony, and that have just very different lifestyle. But we're going to concentrate on honeybees because they are very prevalent. It's normal for a honeybee queen to lay from 1,500 to 2,000 or even more eggs in one day. Mm. Another thing that's interesting about, just sort of a few little facts to start off with, bees, as far as I know, are the only insects for which artificial insemination techniques have been successfully developed.
Really?
And we talk about that in the book. I worked with a guy in Canada who raises bees, and we have a photograph of how they're inseminated. It's all really pretty incredible, but they do that. And we know also that most honeybees only live for a few weeks. So bees have been valued for a long time. There's a lot of data. They're bees like from 3,000 years ago in Egypt. I will probably come to that. I have that somewhere in the book. But they're very important for the honey and for their productivity. In the old days, before there was refined sugar, if you wanted to sweeten anything, honey was it. Well, there were other vegetable sweeteners.
Sorghum they used to use, too.
Sorghum, other things. Okay, I don't want to overdo it, but honey was very important.
Right.
And they have a symbolic value. Okay. They have a symbolic value in that they symbolize diligence. To be busy as a bee is a compliment universally. Honey and beeswax production is valued at approximately $285 million annually in the United States, just to give an idea of the kind of critical role they play. And they're very important in agriculture because they pollinate these huge monoculture crops where they truck thousands of beehives around the country so that when the almond blossoms are full of nectar in California, there are thousands and thousands of beehives there ready for the bees to pollinate the almonds. Then the almonds are finished and the apple crop in New York is blossoming. They've trucked the bees back to New York and they pollinate the apples. So this has some drawbacks for the bees, of course, because it's not a very nice lifestyle. But this is a tremendous industry that has developed.
Mm. So there are guys who just do this.
Tremendous business,
They truck them all over the country.
Right.
Wherever they need pollinators.
And you rent the bees for commercial pollination, exactly.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Okay.
So we're going to stop a minute after we spoke about commercial pollinization and how important it is. And we'll be back in a minute. We're going to take a short break. Remember, this is the Heritage Radio Network, and the program is The Naturalist, Bernie Wise, with my partner, Carol Butler, who's my bee expert today, and our sponsor is Whole Foods Markets. this is Bernie Wides back after a minute of break. And during that minute of break, we had a little discussion about the Mayans with bees. If you go to Mexico in the Yucatan, there's one of the great pyramids. I don't remember if it's the Mayans or the Incas or one of those other peoples that was dedicated to the bees because there are bee sculptures all over it. So the bees were really very important to that civilization, of course, for the honey. And I don't know if they knew about the pollination end of it, but maybe they did. So if you go down to Tulum in Mexico and you go to see that one, it also has this famous stone carving of the descending god, and it looks like a space person. So a lot of people try to make something out of that, but I don't think there's anything to that except that the bees were really important to that culture too. So Carol, what we're going to continue now about bees and... Right. Pick the next topic.
All right. I just want to comment that bees are also symbolic in Salt Lake City, Utah.
Oh, really?
My co-author, Elizabeth Capaldi Evans, went out there and took some wonderful photographs, which are in the book. The State House has a beehive on top of it. You can see it in the book. And there, it's used in, there's a building called the Bee House that has beehives all over it. And it's on signs in the street. We had a photograph, we didn't use it in the book, but a photograph she took of a street sign with a beehive on it. So it's very much the symbol of Salt Lake, which, I mean, it's kind of interesting if you think about the Mormons and the fact that they're polygamous, that it's mostly a female society, which is true of bees as well, except that the male does not have the role that the Mormon male would have in a polygamous family.
That's true.
The male has no role. Okay.
Well,
I guess we should talk about that. We kind of go back and forth here. There are workers and drones and a queen in the hive, right? The different types of bees in the hive. And the workers are really fascinating. They change their job as they develop. So the females do all the work in the hive. And generally, their reproductive organs don't develop. This is called reproductive self-restraint. And it occurs partially because the workers understand that the queen is laying thousands of eggs a day, so they have no reason to lay eggs. But the queen gives off pheromones, and even the larvae give off pheromones. And these chemical signals suppress the workers' ovaries from developing. So there's a whole climate that suppresses their development. That being said, and there are exceptions to most of the things I'll talk about now, because they can do genetic mapping, we've been able to study the workers in some of the European colonies, not we, but Madeline Beekman and Ben Oldroyd. And they found that maybe 1% of the workers in the colonies they studied actually had active ovaries and were able to lay eggs. And
the workers are all female.
The workers are all female and basically not laying eggs.
Okay.
There are some exceptions. They can tell because they can do a genetic analysis of the eggs and they see they're not the queen's eggs.
Okay, and the drones are the males.
And the drones are the males, and they have a tough time. Well, no matter, I don't know how you look at it, but to me it sounds like a tough life. The drones there are maybe 50,000 bees in a hive, and maybe 100 drones. And the drone has no function other than to mate with a virgin queen. The drone develops from an unfertilized egg that the queen lays. Every once in a while, the workers will make a bigger opening in the comb, and they'll take the queen there, and she will lay an unfertilized egg in that comb and in that hole, and that will become a drone.
Mm-hmm.
And the only role the drone plays is outside the nest. The drone is not equipped to collect pollen. They're not equipped to forage or gather nectar. They only, once they're a few days old, they go out to, they beg other, they only... They beg others for food, and they have no function other than to mate with a virgin queen. So they go out to a drone congregation area where they hang around, and the Virgin Queens, I guess, know where that is somehow and fly there on their mating flight, and they will mate with maybe 20 drones at that during several days of mating flights. The drone has compound eyes that are much larger than the same structures on the female, and also has very sensitive antennae that are especially sensitive to queen pheromone. So he's equipped to find a mate if he can.
And that's it. That's his whole role in life.
That's his role. And if he hasn't successfully mated after a week or so, the workers will basically withhold food and throw him out of the colony. And he'll be killed because he's a drain on the group's reserves. So it's a strange life being
strange
a drone.
Life, right. Put out or get out. No, that's not about, really. Well, that's for the queen.
Oh, and we forgot the most important part. When they mate with the queen, their phallus, their equivalent to the penis, breaks off.
Right.
And they drop to the ground and die.
The drones.
So right.
After they copulate with the queen, that's it.
So either way, it's not a strange life. A very short and strange life. Right.
Right. Okay, so that's the drones and...
Right, and the workers.
And the workers are the females.
Well, I wanted to just talk a little bit more about the workers. The workers, what's interesting about them is that they change their jobs as they get older. They are physically the same. There are workers doing different tasks in the hive, but they're all sisters. They're all the same genetically, physically. But because of the pheromones and the age-related transitions that they make, they go from one job to another as they grow.
Mm-hmm.
When they first emerge from the pupa, they begin doing tasks associated with the interior of the nest, bringing food to the larva in the cells, grooming the queen, that kind of work. Until they're about 7 to 10 days old, they consume a protein-rich pollen so that the hypopharyngeal glands in the head fully develop. And these glands produce a fluid that she will then be able to feed to the larvae as her next task.
Okay.
So that's the next stage.
They become nurses.
Wet
nurses.
That's right, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Then as the bee ages a little bit more, she moves on to keeping the hive clean, making wax, participating in building the comb. When she's mature, which means about 3 weeks old, she then first shifts her attention to tasks that bring her in contact with the world outside the nest. That means guarding the entrance and receiving nectar from the forages and placing it in the storage cells. The foragers bring the nectar in, put it into the mouth. They carry it in a crop in their throat or in their abdomen. No, not in their abdomen.
In the throat.
Yeah, crop. And they regurgitate it into the mouth of the worker bees who are waiting to receive it. And then the worker bees... Again, it sort of gets processed inside their bodies. It gets regurgitated into the comb.
Mm-hmm. So that's what.
And only the most mature bee at the end of their life cycle do they forage. Do they actually go out looking for nectar? At the height of their lives, they then wander away from. They forage there, they communicate with each other, they learn where the nectar is, they go and bring the nectar back.
Okay, so they have a changing role in their lives. It's almost like us, you know, you grow up and you get a job and you work, and then hopefully you live long enough and you have enough money to retire. Well, and then you can go foraging out into the world and
Puerto Rico wherever it works for you.
Yeah. Yes, that's because I just returned from Puerto Rico, and I'm going to do a show on Puerto Rico in a couple of weeks. It was a great place to visit, but we'll keep on the topic of the bees today. So,
do we have more time? I hear the music is playing.
We have to take another break.
All right, very
and
good.
And remember, this is Heritage. Oh, there we go, the flight of the bumblebee. All right, Jack's on the job. That's our engineer. And this sounds like bumblebee music or bee music. Right. There is a piece of music called The Flight of the Bumblebee.
Absolutely.
Right. Okay, so we're going to stop for a minute. And remember, our sponsor is Whole Foods Market. and we'll be back. Okay, here we are back on the air, Heritage Radio Network, The Naturalist. I'm Bernie Wides, and my partner is Carol Butler, and we're going to go back to talking about bees because it's such a fascinating topic. Okay. So, Carol, you want to concentrate on the queen now. We haven't said that much about the queen.
Right. The queen is the central figure in the colony. She controls reproduction, and as long as she's laying eggs, everybody's happy. The colony is very stable. We talked about the mating flights already, so I don't need to go into that again. She lives for a couple of years, and as long as she's in good condition, as I said, she will continue to lay eggs. When she starts aging and she stops laying as many eggs, the colony becomes aware of it because they're all focused on raising these little bees, the babies. And at a certain point, when she is failing, when they see that the colony is in danger of not being able to keep its population up, they will feed a special mixture to a worker bee in a larger cell, and this will develop a new queen.
A new queen. That's how the new queen evolves.
And they'll start a few cells with to raise queens, and when the old queen, when the new queen is about to emerge, or when it first emerges, that's when the colony will swarm, which we'll talk about in a later segment.
Yes, we should. That's an important thing, the
right.
swarming.
But the old queen will leave with thousands and thousands of bees, and the new young queen who has just emerged will be in charge. And if more than one young queen emerges at the first one usually is the one who is in charge. If more than one emerges, they'll fight it out, and one will kill the other. And because only one queen can be in the colony, if more than one emerges, sometimes there are secondary swarms, so that if one manages not to get killed, that one may swarm also and start a new colony somewhere else. And you see swarms of bees every once in a while. We have a special person on the New York City police force who's in charge of coming when people call up and say, there's a swarm of bees, because they cluster. They're full of honey. They're not aggressive because they're out there until there are scouts that locate a new location. So they just glom onto a lamppost or something.
Right, when it eaves of a house.
Right,
a lot of time, yeah.
And stay there maybe for a day or two. And then scout bees go out searching for an appropriate new location for the swarm. And somehow they communicate with one another and they reach a consensus and say, this is the place. And then the colony follows them to the new location. Now, here again, we used to think that the scout bees would post themselves at the location of the new swarm and raise their abdomens and give off a certain pheromone which would direct the bees to that location. Somebody had the bright idea of plugging up the scent glands so they couldn't give out the pheromones. To see, they're called Nasanov glands, to see whether that would screw up the relocation of the swarm. And strangely enough, it did not.
Mm-hmm.
Now, bees have 5 eyes, right? They have 2 compound eyes, and then they have 3 eyes on the top of their head that are really just
light-sensitive
cells. They're
right.
not really, they don't
want image.
Right, but yeah. they think now, there is some speculation that the way the scout bees fly very fast, and they fly above the swarm. And the thought is that with the extra eyes on top of the head, the ocelli, they can follow the scout bee to the new location. and that's a way that they find their way.
Yeah. By the way, you mentioned a special guy on the police force who goes out to take care of swarming bees. Well, it used to be illegal to have beehives in New York City, but that's changing. The city council is about to change the law, so more and more people can have beehives.
Well, there was a meeting about it a couple of weeks ago in the city council. Did they make a decision?
I haven't heard, but I know they were going to discuss it and hopefully change it, because there certainly are plenty of places we could have beehives, and it would be nice and good that people don't have to go buy honey.
Right.
And bees are terrific, because they mind their own business, and if you leave them alone, they don't bother anybody at all.
That's right.
And if, the only problem is, if you are really allergic to bee stings, then you shouldn't raise bees, on the chance that you may get stung. But I know that out here in Bushwick, there are beehives, and my daughter Erica, as I said, she's about to set up a hive right here at Roberta's restaurant. So that's another topic that we covered, swarming of bees. And I think what we should do is, some of the terms we use, I think we should go over, like pheromone.
Right.
So what would you say a good definition of pheromone
is? Well, a pheromone is a chemical.
Okay, a chemical messenger.
The chemical messenger, right? Butterflies give off pheromones. Moths give off pheromones as well.
Mm-hmm. What about humans? I think there might be a case for humans also giving off some kind of a pheromone.
Right. Well, there are perfumes that are advertised as pheromones, right?
Yeah.
We could also talk about royal jelly a little bit.
That's right. That's very interesting. So I think... this first show, we don't have enough time to do that, but I think we'll come back and talk about royal jelly in a minute. But this idea of starting a new hive. So when the old queen is not in good shape anymore, they produce a new queen who will take over that hive.
Who will take over the old hive.
Okay, and what about swarming? That when they swarm, they swarm with the queen?
They swarm with the old queen.
The old queen.
Right.
Now, is she going to live much longer, the old queen?
Well, they'll lay eggs and generate a new queen in the new hive.
Okay, but it's the old queen
Right. She swarms, flees for her life with her thousands and thousands of workers.
Right. So it's sort of a mass movement to do that. Okay, right. We have a little time left.
Okay, well, we have zillions of things to talk about. We could talk about how the egg develops. I'm sort of interested in talking about metamorphosis a little bit. The honeybee lays an egg in the chamber. It's like with most insects, right? A larvae emerges. It sheds its skin several times as it grows, because the skin is the exoskeleton. And then when it reaches its the last stage, it actually spins a cocoon for itself, and then it goes into one. It goes inside into the comb.
Okay, one little apartment.
Right, and the difference between butterflies and butterflies have to find food. They have to forage for food. The honeybee larva is fed. That the worker bees come repeatedly during the day and keep bringing it food, so that it doesn't have to go anywhere. And it doesn't even go anywhere to expel the waste. The waste is just collected in the cell and goes down to the bottom of the cell. Mm-hmm. And then they eventually spin this silken cocoon, which helps protect them. And then the comb is sealed up. And they metamorphose, and they come out as an adult bee.
Mm-hmm. So the cell is sealed off with like wax.
Yeah, when they're pupating.
When they're pupating, so that protects
after the fifth molt.
Okay, so
the fifth molt is actually inside the cocoon.
Yeah,
and the pupa is revealed, just like with a moth.
Okay,
right.
I
wanted to say what's interesting: 12% of insects don't go through this kind of metamorphosis. They go through incomplete metamorphosis, which skips the pupal stage.
Mm-hmm.
The adult female lays her eggs, and the eggs hatch into nymphs that look like small adults, but they usually don't have wings. And they molt several times.
Mm-hmm.
And by the time they reach their adult size, they have grown wings. In contrast, I thought you would like this. A cockroach and a human have something in common. Right? We are both continuously developing animals that begin as a small version of our adult selves, right, and just grow larger. The only structural change is the development of reproductive organs
In puberty.
In both the cockroach and the human, and the development of wings, which, of course, unfortunately, we don't do.
No, well, you need American Airlines for that, for wings. So it sounds like we're getting applause here.
I'm hearing applause.
I know we're doing a good job, but right. I don't know where that applause is coming from, Jack. But it's probably from the recording of the music.
Right.
So with that applause, we're going to... there was one other thing I wanted to mention about bees. You said they have an exoskeleton. So
right.
I think we should explain to people that we are vertebrates.
Right.
And we have an internal skeleton.
Right.
But insects are invertebrates. That means that their skin is really their skeleton.
Right.
So it's an exoskeleton
that
makes their body rigid. Otherwise, they would be mush.
And when they're in the larval stage, it splits from the head back, and they shed it.
And
then they're softer inside. The exoskeleton is soft, and it's loose. So they eat. It fills up and then splits again.
Just like butterflies and moths.
Right.
Yeah. So what we're going to do is, that's the end of today's show. Part one on bees, and remember, now you can now make comments about our shows right on the computer. So if you like something, you didn't, or you had a request, please let us know, so we'll know that somebody is listening out there.
Right.
And if you want to contact Heritage Radio Network, the phone number is 718-497-2128. And our sponsor today was Whole Foods Market. And we'll be back next week with part two on bees. And Carol Butler will be here again. She's a terrific guest, and we do well together. So we're signing off the air now. And
thank you for having me.
And we'll see you all next week about buzzing around with the bees.